This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight.
This is the so-called Southern Seven, the fourth meeting that they've had, and the fact that it's happened so early in the year is a real indication of how seriously countries, particularly Spain, Italy, Greece and France, are concerned that they are carrying the burden of all these migrant and refugee arrivals.
That's Catherine Fields reporting. We'll have the full story coming up. Also, day zero approaches as Cape Town, South Africa runs out of water. And Kenya Airways will start direct nonstop flights to New York in October. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the heads of seven southern European states pledged last night to up their efforts to tackle their biggest issue at hand, flows of migrants from war-torn and impoverished countries. The leaders of Cyprus, France, Greece, Italy, Malta, Portugal, and Spain met in Rome for a working dinner and released a statement saying they were firmly committed to a common European policy on migration. Reporter Catherine Field spoke with me about the main issues of concern of the Southern Seven countries.
This is the so-called Southern Seven, the fourth meeting that they've had, and the fact that it's happened so early in the year is a real indication of how seriously countries, particularly Spain, Italy, Greece, and France, are concerned that they are carrying the burden, what they describe as the burden of all these migrant and refugee arrivals. They're very concerned that northern European states are saying that they're not prepared to take any of the migrants who are coming in. And this is really an indication that these countries want the European Union, on the one hand, to change this so-called Dublin law that wherever the migrants arrive, whichever country they arrive in, they have to be dealt with in that country. On the other hand, what has come up that really in these discussions has been that, yes, there have been changes, in particular in Greece and in Italy, there are fewer migrants arriving. There are a lot more migrants now arriving in Spain, and in particular, a lot of new arrivals coming in from Algeria and Morocco. And these so-called southern states want the European Union to recognize that the measures they've put in place so far just haven't worked. And if they close off one avenue for arrival into Europe, another one is just opening up.
What are some of the big things that they focused on in this meeting in terms of migrants?
The big focus is really on what they've called the humanitarian corridors. Now, what that means is that you're setting up, if you like, an air bridge, which would allow countries, and it's already started, countries such as Italy and France, to actually fly in migrants from either Libya or elsewhere in the Sahel, people who really have got a justified need for protection. And that what Italy and France in particular are saying is you have got to go down to these countries, you've got to talk to these people, register there, your asylum request there, and deal with it there, because unless they get the backing from the European Union to deal with those issues there, then migrants going to keep coming across in boats across the Mediterranean.
Why is France still at the forefront of the migrant issue?
Well, the French President Emmanuel Macron has insisted that France cannot take in everyone. In particular, he's referring to the fact that in 2017, France received more than 100,000 requests for asylum. Now, that's a record. It's up 17% from the year before. As far as Emmanuel Macron is concerned, what he also wants is he wants that G5 African military force in the Sahel to not just work in fighting against terrorism, but also to stop people smugglers. And so Emmanuel Macron feels that it's really as much up to the G5 Sahel countries to work on this as well as the European neighbors.
That was reporter Catherine Field speaking with me from Paris. South Africa's city of Cape Town is approaching what the mayor calls day zero, the day the city of 4 million will have to shut off the taps because it has run out of water amid years of drought. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg. The saga has also taken on political tones, with the mayor's warnings being overshadowed by allegations of misconduct.
Day Zero, Cape Town Mayor Patricia DeLille acknowledges, sounds like a Hollywood movie. It is the day the city will implement its harshest water restrictions to date. This week, she explained what will happen when the water supply reaches a new low point.
Then at that point, we will turn off most of the taps. We will not turn off the taps. We will reduce the pressure in poorer areas like informal settlements. But we'll turn off the taps and then at about approximately 200 sites across the city, people will have to go and collect water from there. And when you collect your water from there, you will only receive 25 liters per person per day.
The beautiful beach-lined port city has suffered drought for 3 consecutive years. For months, officials have imposed strict controls on the city's water supply. Capetonians have been banned from washing their cars, watering their lawns, or filling their pools, and have been encouraged to keep showers under 2 minutes and only flush the toilet when absolutely necessary. The latest restrictions, imposed January 1st, slashed each household's monthly allowance nearly in half. But critics of the mayor and her party say it is unfair to blame the situation entirely on the drought. DeLille is a member of the Democratic Alliance Party, which has long ruled the Western Cape Province. The mayor has come under fire for unrelated allegations of misconduct and corruption, which are prompting calls for her dismissal. African National Congress acting party leader in the province, Kaya Magatla, says the Democratic Alliance record of mismanagement is partly to blame for the water crisis.
When this thing was raised more than 5 years ago, that we are undergoing a serious drought in the Western Cape due to the natural causes, including the global warming. But the DA failed to execute mechanism in order to restrict the use of water, in order to manage that process properly, to extend that we are now reacting in a crisis that is already over our head.
Civil society groups like the South African Water Caucus say water allocation is the responsibility of the national government and blame the ANC-led national government for failing to release enough drought funding due to mismanagement and corruption at the national level. Mayor DeLille says she is optimistic that if Capetonians can stick to the limits, they can push Day Zero back.
We can avoid Day Zero if we all work together.
In the meantime, Capetonians hope and pray for Day One of a long, soaking rain. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Kenya Airways will start direct nonstop flights to New York in October. The flights will be the first nonstop flights from East Africa to the United States. The airline's chief executive officer, Sebastian McCose, says tickets go on sale today for the first flight. The eastbound route to New York will take 15 hours and the return to Nairobi will take 14 hours. The U.S. has long banned direct flights from Kenya Airways over security concerns. However, McCose says U.S. and Kenyan security officials have done audits of Jomo Kenyatta International Airport and have determined direct flights are possible. More than a quarter of the world's land could become significantly drier in coming decades, according to new research from Britain's University of East Anglia and China's Southern University of Science and Technology. Scientists warn that changes in precipitation and evaporation linked to climate change could increase the likelihood of domino effects like prolonged droughts and forest fires, Henry Ridgewell reports.
Scientists looked at the effect of a 2-degree increase in temperatures on the aridity of different regions, a measure of the dryness of the land surface. Manoj Joshi of the University of East Anglia was part of the research team.
And what we found was that the regions that changed significantly, substantially, compared to the year-to-year variations of the past, were regions such as Southeast China, Central North America, northern parts of South America, Southern Africa, Mediterranean.
The Paris Climate Agreement, signed in 2015, aims to limit global warming to 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels.
What we found was that in these 6 regions that we looked at, you can actually limit the amount of aridification if you stay underneath a 2-degree temperature rise globally.
So what would a significantly drier world look like?
The future average climate will be like the drier years of the present day. It's like encountering a moderate drought, that never stops. If you are interested in impacts such as drought, if you're interested in agriculture, even things like heat stress, and knock-on effects of drought, potentially forest fires, for instance, for all these impacts, aridity is really important.
California has just suffered some of the worst forest fires in the state's history. More than 5,500 square kilometers were engulfed by fire in 2017, and almost 50 people killed.
Climate change will make certain things more likely. I mean, forest fires and dry regions may be one of those things. But you can't take a certain impact and just assume this is because of climate change. That's not how climate science works.
Many regions are already experiencing chain reaction effects of rising temperatures. The researchers warn that agriculture, biodiversity and water quality would all be impacted as vast areas of land become drier. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The Zimbabwe Electoral Commission has initiated another phase of its nationwide voter registration blitz. This comes after calls for the exercise to continue after it ended in December, having registered fewer people than expected. Reporter Kudzazi Zvinovashi reports.
In preparation for elections later this year, Zimbabwe has been compiling a new voters' roll using biometric voter registration system known as BVR. Commissioner Emmanuel Magade is the acting chairperson of Zimbabwe Electoral Commission.
The Zimbabwe Electoral Commission embarked on a national biometric voter registration exercise during the period running from the 14th of September 2017 to the 19th of December 2017. This exercise resulted in a provisional total of 4,879,482 voters being registered countrywide.
He says during the same period, the Registrar General was on a drive to issue identification cards to Zimbabweans around the country. He says, however, there were irregularities in the two campaigns.
The voter and civil registration exercises were initially not synchronized, resulting in some people being left out of the voter registration blitz, or our period of intensity. After observing this anomaly and challenge, representations from various stakeholders on the BVR exercise to the commission were made.
Wednesday, the ZEC kicked off another registration blitz. It was ordered mainly because of the ID card problem, as well as the December High Court order allowing Zimbabweans classified as aliens to vote.
The commission is of the view that these representations are legitimate and well-founded. As a result, we have decided to embark upon a mop-up exercise that will be conducted in order to afford every Zimbabwean an opportunity to register to vote.
The mop-up exercise runs until the 8th of February. There were long lines of people this morning at one registration center in Harare. Danford Ngaidzore, a youth leader in the opposition movement for democratic change, has been monitoring the registration process.
We are very much happy. High turnout is very good, it's promising. And actually, we have more youths who have come to register to vote. So it's something which is very promising, considering the economic challenges which the country is facing.
The ZEC had initially aimed to register 7 million voters, but has since revised that target, saying it was overly ambitious. Magade says he will be happy to register more than 5 million people. Political activists hope this period will be enough to register Zimbabweans missed on the last round, as well as nearly 1 million people classified as aliens. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zvinovashi from Harare.
Authorities in Tunisia say more than 500 people have been arrested after 3 days of violent protest over government-imposed austerity measures. Security forces have been deployed in several cities to quell the demonstrations. They began Monday in response to new tax increases included in the new government budget. Authorities say over 300 people were arrested yesterday alone. Protesters hurled homemade gasoline bombs at a Jewish school on Tunisia's tourist island of Djerba earlier this week. Well, a new public opinion poll indicates deep economic unease in Tunisia, but popular satisfaction with the progress of the government's anti-corruption campaign. The poll was done by the International Republican Institute based in Washington, D.C. The survey shows an overwhelming majority describe the current economic situation as either very bad or somewhat bad, and believe the country is headed in the wrong direction. Under 40% think that their personal financial situation of their household will improve in the next year. Brian Braun is the program director for Tunisia at the Institute. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi about the findings of the poll.
There were a couple findings that really stuck out to us from this latest survey. The first is the continued intense dissatisfaction with economic situation. You know, the recent protests are a good illustration of this, but some of the figures really stood out, especially 89% of Tunisians think that the economic situation is either somewhat or very bad, and only 37% expect their household financial situation to improve within the next year. However, we also saw in the data that there is broad support for the government's war on corruption. 54% of Tunisians think that the government is doing either a somewhat or very good job fighting corruption, and 55% are satisfied with Prime Minister Shahad's self-proclaimed war on corruption. And then we also noticed that the poll showed a positive perception of the capacity of elected municipal and regional governments. 68% believe that elected local councils are going to improve communications between government and citizens. And similar numbers think that the elections will lead to less corruption and economic improvement and better services. I think the sort of the primary takeaway for all of this is that now is more important than ever that the Tunisian government pursues institutional reforms that address corruption and promote sustainable long-term growth.
A majority of Tunisians believe that they would prefer better economy to a democratic system of government. What does that mean?
I think the figures that you're referring to, namely that roughly twice as many Tunisians consider prosperity more important than democracy, really just underscores how extreme economic frustration can undermine democratic consolidation, especially in a young and fragile democracy like Tunisia. And I think it also underscores the need for Tunisian decision makers to utilize the opportunities at their disposal, like the broad public support for anti-corruption, in order to institute crucial reforms that can improve the economy and build trust in the democratic governance process.
What message Tunisians are sending to the government when a majority of Tunisians have unfavorable ratings of leading political parties in the government and believe that ministries and parliament are doing nothing to address the needs of the Tunisian citizens?
I think that it's important to note that the favorability ratings for all major political parties and figures across the board rose, so that's important to keep in mind. However, the unfavorability ratings do illustrate the point that politicians need to do a better job demonstrating to the Tunisian people that they're listening. Again, the recent protests demonstrate, you know, the difficult job of managing a delicate economic situation and delivering on people's demands. But the survey had some interesting findings, one of which was that 66% of Tunisians think that a clear platform is more important than a strong leader, which I think really indicates that Tunisians are looking for clear policies and solutions to some of these problems.
But only 16% of Tunisians believe that the government anti-corruption efforts are very good. What's missing in this campaign?
A majority of Tunisians are still satisfied with the government's anti-corruption initiatives, but the Tunisian people may be giving the prime minister the benefit of the doubt to address what is undoubtedly a very complex and systemic problem in Tunisia. Interestingly, 57%, our poll revealed, believe that wasta, or personal connections, is very important to getting things done. And I think that this really illustrates how deep-rooted corruption really may be in Tunisian society. Also, I think given the broad public support for the government's anti-corruption initiatives, it really further reinforces how now is a sort of crucial moment for the prime minister and cabinet to press for further reforms to address corruption.
That was Mohammed El-Shanawi speaking with Brian Braun. In another look at voter registration in Zimbabwe, pro-democracy activists say two of the three Matabeleland provinces are among those with the lowest number of registered voters. They base their claims on a recently ended biometric registration drive. Some blame the situation on a lack of identity documents by many locals and on civil strife during the early years of independence. Corruption, our correspondent Torai Shava has the story.
The close of the fourth phase of the voter registration exercise showed Bulawayo province with over 220,000 people registered. That's barely half of the province's projected number of voters. In Matabeleland South Province, about 57% of the potential voters were registered, as compared to a little over 74% in Matabeleland North. Human rights activist Thomas Stole says in Bulawayo alone, thousands of people were turned away from registering for not having proper identity documents. He says the problem is linked to the Gukura Hundi. That's the name for the civil strife in the early 80s, where North Korean-trained army units killed over 20,000 civilians in Matabeleland and parts of the Midlands provinces. Ipitule Maposa is the spokesperson for ZAPU, most of whose supporters were the target of the massacres. ZAPU and its leadership were considered at the time to be rivals of the ruling ZANU-PF party. Maposa says the state has never wanted to acknowledge or speak openly about the violence, though they are descendants of direct victims who do not have identity documents. He says the problem has become generational and can only be resolved when the authorities stop pretending the killings never occurred.
We have children of direct victims of the genocide who were born and grew up without any proper documentation. They since have had their own children who as well don't have the documentation that is required. So we have had a generation of citizens in Matabeleland and Midlands with no proper documentation as a result of the Gukura Hundi genocide.
Maposa's views were backed by a recent meeting in Bulawayo between civic society groups and some political parties, including the Movement for Democratic Change led by Morgan Tsvangirai. MDCT's Secretary General Douglas Monzora says the lack of legal documentation needs to be addressed urgently. Patla Tambo works with the Center for Public Engagement, a Bulawayo-based think tank. It's part of a coalition of civic organizations known as the Platform for Leveraging Democracy, Governance and Elections. He says the lack of identity documents is a serious problem, not only in Matabeleland, but in other regions as well, including the province of the capital, Harare. It showed only a little over half of all prospective voters had registered, an issue he blames in part on apathy.
There is a new crop of young people who have never registered to vote, who have never voted in their whole lives. There has been very little, maybe, voter education from the civic society organizations that has been done to entice the young population to go and go out and register and vote.
The Zimbabwean Election Support Network is a civic organization involved in advocacy for election reform and voter education. Its leaders cite another reason for the problem: the lack of adequate voter education, as well as disinformation and misinformation. Chairperson Andrew Makoni says his group's efforts to assist the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission, or ZEC, in voter education have been hampered by lack of information from the electoral body.
The challenge has been the absence of disaggregated data by sex, age and geographical location provided by ZEC. If we had this data, our work would have been targeted to these specific areas or specific demographics where there's been noticeable gaps.
According to ZEC, about 65% of the country's 7.2 million possible voters are registered. A mop-up registration exercise will begin January 5th and end on February 13th. Reporting for VOA from Bulawayo, this is Taurai Shava.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.